Welcome to the Builders Podcast, an audio production of the Lawrenson Center for Faith and Work at Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota. Every other week, we feature the story of a builder, someone who has been involved in putting together an organization, business, or movement that makes this world a better and more trustworthy place. We ask them to tell that story, share some of their insights, and connect their project to a larger sense of vocation and purpose in this world. I'm your host, Michael Chan, director of the Lawrenson Center at Concordia College. This entire year, the Lawrenson Center is exploring the question, how do we build a more trustworthy world? To learn more about this theme and our upcoming events and opportunities, click the links below. Professor Riaz Aziz, welcome to Builders Podcast.
Happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, once we met one another just last week at the Offutt retreat. You were there as a faculty member, and I started to hear a little bit about your story and especially your nonprofit work in India, and I thought, we have got to get you on this podcast because it just matches up so well with our priorities. So thanks for agreeing to do this.
I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. Well, let's begin just with your professional career. I think when people think of academics, they often have in mind a person who goes from undergrad to maybe master's and PhD straight into the academy. That was not your story. And so let's hear a little bit about that.
No, my story was like I always wanted to be an airline pilot, or at least I thought I did. So I went and got all my education to want to be an airline pilot, spent an enormous amount of money, only to realize that I'm actually interested in flying a plane on a more social level, if you will, as opposed to flying paid as a pilot. And so I left that and went into management. So I went into the airline industry as a project leader, a project manager, and as a financial analyst. And then I had a chance to be recruited into government, if you will. So that was the private part of it. So I was
all in the U.S. Airline. All this was happening
all
in the U.S.
In the U.S. I've been here for over 50 years now. Mm. And so from the airline industry, which is the private sector there, there were a lot of challenges in the airline industry, particularly during the Gulf War when the airlines lost a lot of income, very similar to during the COVID period. Mm. So it was at that time that I chose to make a change, and I got into being a CEO in Minnesota government at the county level and then at the city level. So I got a chance to dabble for about a dozen years or so in government, if you will. And after that, I got recruited to academia because I had friends in the industry that I had studied with and worked with and said, hey, you know, what are you doing now? And I said, well, I'm not sure. They said, well, why don't you give this a try? So I started doing this about 13 years ago. And since then, that's history. So private sector, public sector, and then academia.
That is such a remarkable, I mean, in many ways, you have inhabited three major kind of institution types within the U.S. that are often contrasted with one another, right? Like the private sector in business and then the public sector and then now in higher education. What is it like to just kind of pivot among those different institutions?
Well, you have to understand that those institutions have different focuses, you know, and you have to learn to accept that. In the private sector, profit is the driver. Now, that doesn't mean you just don't care about anything else, but without profit, you don't exist, okay? So when you move to the public sector, being in government, service is the focus. Okay. How do you serve the public? Making sure the roads are well maintained, the social services, law enforcement, public health, and all of those aspects of it. And that's what I was a CEO at. So there is it's not that you don't focus on the dollar, but you're primarily focusing on providing service. Hmm. And then when you move from there to academia is again teaching, it's research, it's new ideas, it's concepts, it's evolving, if you will. It's dealing with people of varying ages. Between the ages of 18 all the way to their late 30s, mm-hmm. early 40s. So you have a different constituents along the way, you know. So on each step of of my career, you start to realize there's a different audience, there's a different customer base, there are different interests there. And if you're not willing to pivot using your own words, you don't do very well.
Yeah, and I know that entrepreneurship is really important part of how you think about yourself probably and think about your own teaching. Talk a little bit about how just kind of entrepreneurship shapes how you think about the world and think about the work you're doing in the classroom.
Sure. entrepreneurship is more than just how do I start a new business or how do I open up a new venture, if you will. Entrepreneurship is also about ideas that we don't know even exist. I mean, when you think back just a couple of decades ago, the idea that you could use your phone to talk with, to listen to music with, to download images with as a camera, if you will, to be able to use yours as your cell phone as a credit card, those things were just unthinkable, okay? And so that's what entrepreneurship is doing the things that you passionately believe in, but also doing the kinds of things that maybe people haven't thought about yet.
Yeah. I've a number of colleagues and I have been reading a book called Unimaginable by, and I can't remember her name, she does futurist type stuff, but it's that notion, though, of thinking what might seem ridiculous at this current moment or sort of outlandish at this current moment and then turning it into a venture that, in the case of the public sector, might be in service to others. In the case of business, might produce profit. But I think that notion of kind of thinking the unimaginable and turning it into a project or venture is sort of, it sounds like that's what's at the heart of how you think about entrepreneurship.
Yeah, absolutely. Like when I was in the airline industry, one of the projects I was working on with the team was, would people actually like to check in at the airline desk on their own? And will they actually take responsibility for their own luggage? Now, that contrast from the decade before that, where you actually had interacted with a live person who gave you many pages. The tickets used to be like 6, 7, 8 pages long.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And you would actually tear off each page for each of the segments, if you will. Someone else tagged your bag. Someone else put it on the airline. Now, it may seem like a very small concept, but it has saved the airline industry millions of dollars getting you to check in, if you will. Yeah. There's no need to print boarding passes. Now, today we take it as commonplace.
We tag our own bags now.
We tag
for
our own
the most part.
Exactly. Yeah. So we don't even think much about it. But think about this 20 years ago. That would have been like, what do you mean I've got to tag my own bag? Now, just those little slight differences, okay, can make a huge difference. And so I think it's just ideas that helps us live better lives. Think about the concept of Amazon. The idea that you could get just about anything you want brought to your door.
Within days. Sometimes same day.
Exactly. Was an unthinkable concept just a few decades ago. So those are the concepts, those are the kinds of things entrepreneurs are looking at and trying to imagine. And every idea doesn't have to be a grand idea. It is just taking that small idea and building upon it that lead to some of these incredible things that we take for granted today.
Well, and you continue to operate in that entrepreneurial space in the nonprofit space. And that's where I'd love to turn to next, is that you have a nonprofit. And tell us a little bit about that story. Give us the name of the nonprofit, the idea behind it, and maybe some of the history there.
Sure. The nonprofit is called Begunahi. That's Begunahi.
We'll have the link in the notes.
Sure,
yeah.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. .org. And the nonprofit actually started 10 years ago. In fact, this is our 10th year. It was just a coincidence. I traveled to India with my wife, and I couldn't sleep. We got there, and of course, there's a 12-hour time difference. And so I told her, I said, you sleep, I'm going to go down to the lobby. And I met this young woman at a reception desk, at the front desk, of course, at 3 in the morning, you know, the lobby's empty, and so forth. And we began chatting, and she had pictures of two young girls behind her. And I said, those must be your sisters or, your siblings, because she looked very young, too. And she said, no, those are actually my daughters. And I kind of looked at her and said, well, she's not old enough to have daughters like that. Well, interestingly enough, she basically rescued these two girls from a very, very hard situation, a brothel in India, raised them as her own, and gave them a new life.
Wow.
And so it was a fascinating story to hear someone as young as she was. She was probably in her mid to late 20s, if you will, and the girls were teenagers. So that's why I was surprised that they were daughters. And the idea that you could actually make such a huge impact in the lives of others struck me, meeting somebody for real. There's a big difference between writing a check and sending it off and saying, I've made a donation to this group. And there's nothing wrong with that, by the way. Okay, we've done that. We did it for many, many years. But that's far different from saying, I want to get my hands involved. I really want to use my hands to make a difference. So I came back to my room. My wife was still asleep. And I sat down in the room. I thought about it, waited for her to wake up. And we had this great conversation about how can we make a difference in somebody's lives. So 10 years ago, we started a foundation, not knowing anything about how to do one of these things. Again, India is, you know, nearly 9,000, between 8,000 and 9,000 miles away from the United States. The time difference is day here, night there. So we started a foundation, and the focus of our foundation is to pick that woman, that girl, from the poorest slums of India that's a diamond in the rough, that has the potential for being the next entrepreneur or being the next college grad or whatever, and giving her that opportunity that right now economically holds her back. And that was that's what we wanted to do, and so we started doing that. And in the last 10 years, we've helped out about 130 wow. Women. And many have asked me, well, why only women? Aren't there poor boys? And the answer is yes. But there's one clear distinction: if two people were born at the same day to the same to different mothers, okay, all things being equal, poverty wise, everything else. Same zip code and everything. Mm-hmm. 30 seconds after the birth, this mother gives birth to a boy, this mother gives birth to a girl. Within 30 seconds, there is a difference. He being born a boy, from that moment on, in spite of the poverty, in spite of being all things being equal, still has an upper leg and the girl that was born at the same time he was, in developing countries anyway. And so our focus has strictly been women. And so we've helped out many. We send them to college, and we take care of their needs, 100% of their needs. The day after they finish high school, when we bring them into our program, all the way through college, and 5 years after they get their jobs and career started. The whole idea is to make sure that they don't fall through any cracks along the way.
And you see the most of those cracks being in that time covered, in which you all are covering, helping to cover their expenses.
Right.
That's when they're most vulnerable to falling through, right?
Exactly. They're most vulnerable. And not only that, we're very fortunate. You know, we have uncles and aunts, friends or neighbors who are educated, who have access to things. These girls come from some of the poorest parts of India, where there is no family member with any connections, with any knowledge, with any expertise, with any resources. So simply writing them a check and saying, congratulations, you won the scholarship, you know, go conquer the world and good luck. That is a setup for failure. You have to stay with them to the very end. And the end in our case is being defined 5 years after graduation and starting getting you know, into a career.
And, remind me again, how long have you all been in this work?
We've been doing this for 10 years.
For 10 years.
Yeah.
I didn't ask you to prepare for this, so it's no problem if you need a moment to think about it. What are some of the stories of these women that are just kind of at the top of your mind that are particularly meaningful?
Sure. I can talk about several of them, but one in particular, her parents basically lost everything. For a series of reasons, and they ended up living under a bridge, which is like an overpass. Okay, they call them bridge there, an overpass. And she was engaged at the age of 15, which is often happens to women, especially in smaller towns, because our older sister was engaged at 16 and married off at 17. She basically begged her family to break off the engagement. And a year later, they did break it off. But then the question was, well, what do you do now? Okay.
Right.
And she said, well, I want her to study. I want to go to college. I want to make something of myself. And the parents go, well, we don't have any resources to be able to do that. So she goes out there and talks to everybody that was willing to give her any chance in life. Talking from one to another, she eventually heard about my foundation that my wife and I, by the way, run together, contacted us. We happened to be heading to India a few days later. We met her there. We found her to be very, very intelligent, an incredibly bright-eyed young woman. So we basically put her into a private college. not that different from Concordia, in fact. They were one of the few private colleges in India, and she got her bachelor's degree majoring in mathematics, minoring in physics.
Wow.
Yeah. And then we hinted to her and said, would you be interested in pursuing a master's degree, but it doesn't have to be in India. You could be in India, that's fine. India's got many wonderful, fine institutions. And so she said, oh, okay, I don't mind trying, but I just think it's too much. And I'm happy to tell you that she is here in the United States right now pursuing her PhD in mathematics.
Wow. What a story.
So, one story.
What an incredible story. And just be able to see and document the impact there.
Absolutely.
Because had that intervention not come, you imagine her life would be quite different.
Because again, you know, you have to understand that every child that is not married is another mouth to feed. If you're poor indeed, and getting married means, again, it's family, it's children. India is changing. The developing world is changing, where women do have more rights. They do work out of the home, especially in larger cities like Delhi and Mumbai and Chennai and places like that. But a lot of other places, the traditional family, where the woman's job is to take care of the home and, you know, the kids and so forth, prevails. And so, yes, life would have been very different for her.
Tell us the name of the organization one more time and then explain it to us, because it means innocence, right?
Right. Yeah. The word is Begunahi, Begunahi, and in the world and the Hindi language, which is the main language of India, that word means innocence. Okay. And the question was, why innocent? Well, when a girl is 14 or 15 and when she's 16 or 15 and she gets married, okay, she loses out all the opportunities a woman in America would experience between the ages of 15 and, say, 25, 26, or whenever she's ready to marry. She goes to college. She learns to think. She maybe become an entrepreneur. She might create something, if you will. She gets to stand independently on her own two feet and is an equal partner and contributor, hopefully, in that marriage relationship. But when you get married that young, you pretty much are going from childhood to adulthood overnight. And so you lose much more than the opportunity just to live and, you know, grow, but you're losing the sense of innocence of humanity. Humanity is designed so that we all evolve over time. We all are. I mean, even at my age, I'm continuing to evolve in terms of my understanding of the world around me. Imagine all that taken away from you. So it's the loss of innocence between a child and an adult when you get married, because marriage gets to be the main focus of many girls in developing countries, because that's the way of, again, it's doing the responsibility of finding her a husband. It's one less mouth to feed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's the reason why that's the reason we chose the name.
Yeah.
And we call it Innocence, and that's it's become the trademark of our organization now.
Oh, that's remarkable. And really, you're talking about the breaking of the cycle of kind of multi-generational poverty. I think that's at least how I'm hearing part of your priorities. And what's your sense about how sticky that will be, you know, for these young women and assuming they have children and, you know, future generations? How sticky is that going to
be
for them?
I'll give you one simple statistic. Okay. Yeah. And this speaks it all. Okay. In developing worlds, or for the matter, even in non-developing world, a woman who's not been educated, the probability that she will educate her children lie in the mid to high 20%. Okay, 22, 25, 27%.
If she's not educated.
If she's not educated, her sense of focusing on educating her children is much less. Okay, because she's in poverty, and then that limits it. An educated woman in a developing country, the probability that she will educate her children is 97%.
Oh, remarkable.
So if you're looking for a return on an investment,
right,
there it is. So if you want to break a cycle of poverty, it's not just about writing checks and donating funds. That's just one piece of it. It's making sure that, I mean, they don't have to lose their language. They don't have to lose their culture. They don't have to come to America necessarily. This just happened to be in this example I shared with you earlier. But it's giving them the opportunity to break that cycle so that their children and the generation after them doesn't have to repeat itself over and over again, like it's been done for many, many years. You know, most of the girls are not, in fact, 90% of the girls that we educate, their family, if you look back generation after generation after generation, they've done the same thing. They've been hourly labor employees living from paycheck to paycheck, and the cycle has never been broken because that's what they know.
Right, right. It's amazing. So talk about the selection process. Sure. That's really fascinating to me, the way that you all kind of look for those kind of special women in large numbers of people. What are the things you're looking for?
Well, obviously, we're looking for somebody that truly wants an education. Not everybody does, okay? Mm. So we can't force feed the issue. So number one. The second thing is we are also looking for this woman who has the support of our family. Because remember, we're not just breaking the cycle. We're actually in some ways interfering with the grand order of things in what is cultural.
Okay.
Embedded, okay? When a culture believes that a woman is put on this planet to become a wife and a mother and so on and so forth, you are sort of interfering with that, if you will. So you need to have the family support. So we're looking for not only the child or the young woman who wants to do this, who wants to, like, you know, think of her life as being much more than, you know, being a spouse at the age of 15 or 16. We also need we're also looking for her parents to support. And in some cases, it takes some convincing.
Well, I wondered about that. Yeah, if you ever kind of have to work through issues.
We've actually had parents that have told us, no, under no circumstances can our daughter go to college, or it doesn't matter what she wants. Or in some cases, that's fine. It's great that you want to do that. But these are all the conditions that they want. For example, we have conditions too.
Right.
A woman must have her own bank account. It's a sense of independence.
Yeah.
Not jointly with the father or the brother, but her own. She has to have a smartphone, our own, something that allows her to look at the world beyond her small village.
Wow.
Because through the internet connection. We give her the money to pay for the fees so that she then takes pictures of the receipts and sends it back to us. The idea is she takes ownership and responsibility. The kind of things that young women in America do all the time, you know, but we take it for granted because this is how our life, whereas in other parts of the world, it's not necessarily the case. So we're not just trying to educate the young woman, we're also trying to give her all those pieces that suggest you can be independent. You can still hold on to your culture or your faith or your position, your role in society and everything. You don't have to give all that up, but you can also add to it the sense of independence that I'm an individual. I get to make these decisions. When I marry, who I marry, do I want to have a children or not? What careers do I want to start? You know, where do I want to live, et cetera, et cetera.
Wow. Well, this is such a compelling story. I'm really glad that we had a chance to capture it today. I wonder, have we missed anything? Is there anything else you want to lift up about this work?
Well, you know, the one question you asked was, how do we go about doing this?
Right.
It's a combination of effort. We work from the United States, obviously, here from Minnesota, and that's our entire institution is based here. We have no staff on the ground. So our communication with them happens daily, every week, I'm saying. We speak to all the girls. And we also visit India once, if not twice a year, to make that real connection. So how does that happen? We actually go into the slums, into the villages. We sit down with the parents in their hearts, in their homes, to have this one-on-one relationship building, if you will. Mm-hmm. And that's what evolves. So I would basically tell to your listeners that anybody's interested in wanting to make a difference, and I don't necessarily mean with our organization, and that's fine if you do. We welcome you. But there are people here, there are people all over the world that need help. And every one of us is capable of making a difference. I know that we are working towards hard to have the next bigger house or the next car or the next degree or whatever that we want to have. And that's fine. You know, this country gives us those opportunities. But in the meantime, as you progress up the ladder, remember, there's a lot that you can do to give back. And I will tell you this, with all my careers, in my time here in Concordia as well, the best job I've ever had is running my foundation. The return on the investment, both emotionally and in terms of what you see happening in the world, is priceless. And I would encourage anybody who's ever thought about wanting to do something like this, in whatever form or shape it takes, to go ahead and make it happen. Okay, there is no perfect time. Okay, the time is now. If you want to do it, make it happen. And you can change lives on your own, you know, and you can do it every day.
I can't think of a better way to end. Professor Riaz Aziz, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Builders Podcast. Please subscribe and leave a review. And if you'd like to learn more about the Lorenzen Center, click the links below for additional information.